So today I'm going to talk about the intolerance of cancel culture. Last Shabbat I had framed Purim and the actions of Haman through the narrative of today, that is cancel culture. I had shared with you several definitions that you can go back and look at, the notes posted online to refresh your memories. But for today, let me provide you with this definition. Cancel culture, or what is known also as call-out culture, is a modern form of ostracism in which someone is thrust out of social or professional circles, whether it be online or on social media. In other words, they have been removed from the conversation, they've been ostracized, they've been kicked out of the camp, so to speak, similar to Miriam when she had Sa'aretz, she was taken outside the camp for a week. We saw this recently with a gentleman by the name of Chris Harrison. Who is Chris Harrison, you might ask? Some of you probably already know. Chris Harrison, who has become synonymous with the Bachelor franchise, after hosting every season of it and its spin-offs since its inception nearly two decades ago. I am not a partaker in watching The Bachelor or The Bachelorette, but keeping in mind I do read a lot. So when things come about that can be used for sermon fodder, I take advantage. So he was recently interviewed by a woman by the name of Rachel Lindsay, a former Bachelorette and the franchise's first black lead. During the interview, she asked him about whether Bachelor contestant Rachel Kirkconnell and Harrison was asked about her having dressed up at an antebellum era inspired party. It's like, okay, what's that? The antebellum South, known as the antebellum era or plantation era, was a period in the history of the southern United States from the late 18th century until the American Civil War. Here's another cancel one. Think of Gone with the Wind. That's been canceled. It's that type of backdrop, so to speak. So she went dressed in historical garb based on the American South of the 18th century. And Chris Harrison was asked about this. Harrison replied that until we hear what Kirkconnell has to say, and she has since apologized, he said this, we all need to have a little grace, a little understanding, a little compassion, rather than letting the woke police do the judge, jury, and executioner thing online. This was his response to the question. Harrison basically called out the cancel culture for their tactics of overreacting with few facts, limited information, and no response from the people in question. We have seen this rear view judgment of the past by the standards of today continue. Megyn Kelly simply asked the question back in 2008, is wearing blackface on Halloween racist? She would ultimately lose her job due to the backlash for the question and her opinion. We have seen this play out over the last few years when newly revealed photos of some prominent people dressed up in costume for a part, including makeup, to authenticate the costume. Justin Trudeau, Prime Minister of Canada and the son of former Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, did so at least on three occasions. There were three different photos of him dressed up with makeup. During the 2016 segment on The View, Joy Behar, an outspoken liberal, displayed a 1970s-era photo of herself at a Halloween party when she was 29. She said that the hair was her own and that she had dressed as a beautiful African woman. Yet today, that's being called out. So at the time of the action, there was no outcry in that it was not uncommon for people to dress in costume and use makeup to change the tone of their skin. Yet the outrage that ensues years later, after the fact, has become nuclear. Thus, the reaction to Harrison's comments were as such. Of course, corporate entertainment media spun the whole 14-minute interview as if Harrison had said racism several years ago was okay, which is quite a gross representation of the segment, meaning it was overrepresented. So what transpired as a result of Harrison's comments? As you would think, he issued an apology online that read like a hostage letter and stepped away from hosting, at least for the finale, but it seems he has no plans to give up his post. He says, "I plan to be back and I want to be back," Harrison told Michael Strahan, who's on Good Morning America. This was that interview. "There is much more work to be done," he says, "and I am excited to be part of that change." So he's not giving up. Yet Harrison recently left his position as host due to influence of social media pressure. Zempel, which there's a link to this article. I've been quoting some of the items from this article, and they're italicized. Zempel writes the following. His desperate desire to keep his job might explain why we saw Harrison, once a self-assured and respectable man, now lies prostrate at the feet of the woke police. He warned about begging for forgiveness, understanding, and employment. The transformation in Harrison's persona between who we've seen on TV for years, including in this interview with Lindsay and his Good Morning America interview, is absolutely staggering, she writes. She goes on to say, in his allegedly racist interview with Lindsay, Harrison sounded like a natural and gracious guy, handling a tough conversation as many normal people would, including representing many Americans' view on cancel culture and the online outrage mob. So the threat of cancel culture is real. I've talked about it last week. I've talked about it over the last year. The actions of cancel culture can be devastating. You can lose your job. You can be hounded, either online or in person. You can be bullied. And thus the bar by which one could be canceled is ever changing, while lowering it at the same time. It doesn't take much. A past photo, an errant comment, support for a specific position. Now the stamp would come out and say canceled on it, but I don't have the graphics for that. Thus, there is no tolerance should you be on the other side of any issue that is not supported by the vast woke cancel community. There is no grace, no mercy, no tolerance in this quick draw, shoot first and get answers later. I want to reassure you that Adonai is not of the same ilk, the same nature. In Numbers 23:19, God is not a human who lies or a mortal who changes his mind. When he says something, he will do it. When he makes a promise, he will fulfill it. Malachi 3:6, but because I, Adonai, do not change, you sons of Israel will not be destroyed. Isaiah chapter 40, verses 6 through 8, a voice says, proclaim. And I answer, what should I proclaim? All humanity is merely grass, all its kindness like wildflowers. The grass dries up, the flower fades. When a wind from Adonai blows on it, surely the people are grass. The grass dries up, the flowers fade, but the word of our God will stand forever. Psalm 119, verses 89 and 90. Your word continues forever, Adonai, firm, fixed in heaven, your faithfulness through all generations. You establish the earth and it stands. And then finally, Psalm 102, verses 24 through 27. I pleaded, God, your years last through all generations. So don't take away when my life is half over. In the beginning you laid the foundation of the earth. Heaven is the work of your hands. They will vanish, but you will remain like clothing. They will all grow old. Yes, you will change them like clothing and they will pass away. But you remain the same and your years will never end. So Adonai does not change, nor do his mitzvot, his commandments. For they existed before time began, eternal as he is, becoming made known within the confounds of time, establishing righteousness as the bar he desires his people to attain, thus leading to life, continuing upon the completion of time and the return to eternity, thus the fulfillment of life as being eternal. The same standard that was, is, and is to come. For we read in Revelation 1, 7, and 8, look, he is coming with the clouds. Every eye will see him, including those who pierced him. And all the tribes of the land will mourn him. I am the Aleph and the Tav, says Adonai, God of heaven's armies, the one who is, who was, and who is coming. In other words, a term that has been used a lot lately in relation to the standards by which this pandemic is being managed does not apply to Adonai. He does not move the goalposts, meaning he does not change the standard of his mitzvot, thus causing his people to transgress due to the changing of the rules. The goalpost being moved, meaning it's harder to attain the goal. His goalposts are fixed, so we never have to doubt the standards by which he desires we are to live by. Ultimately, these are his standards. Consider this week's parsha and the golden calf. Adonai did not assume something or take something the people did out of context, viewing their actions of the past by the standards of the present. He didn't do that either. No, remember, for Adonai, his view remains constant. He does not change with time or transform through an enlightened human mind. No goalposts or move. Thus, we have certainty. Thus, Adonai responds to his people, for their actions are not based on social media influence, but on the facts, and just the facts, relating to their actions, their own actions, and evaluated based on his mitzvot. We read in Exodus chapter 32 and verse 1, when the people saw that Moses was taking a long time to come down from the mountain, they gathered around Aaron and said to him, get busy and make us gods to go ahead of us. Because as Moses, the man that brought us up from the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him. Fear was their excuse because Moses had been gone for so long, and they believed they were abandoned in the desert to die alone. Thus, the influence of Egypt still resided. It resided in the people as they thought the answer was to create a god for themselves. We read in verses 2 through 4, Aaron said to them, have your wives, sons, and daughters strip off their gold earrings and bring them to me. The people stripped off their gold earrings and brought them to Aaron. He received what they gave him, melted it down, and made it into the shape of a calf. The people said, Israel, here is your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt. The chain of events have been set in motion, for the true transgression has not fully occurred yet. We read in verses 5 and 6, on seeing this, Aaron built an altar in front of it and proclaimed, tomorrow is the feast for Adonai. Early the next morning they got up, offered burnt offerings, and presented peace offerings. Afterwards the people sat down to eat and drink. Then they got up to indulge in revelry. Now the line has been crossed. They built an altar, presented offerings on the altar, to this image they identified as Adonai and had a celebration in the midst of this image. The people's transgression was significant because not too long ago they heard these words, "I am Adonai your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the abode of slavery. You are to have no other gods before me. You are not to make for yourselves a carved image of any kind of representation of anything in heaven above, on the earth beneath, or in the waters below the shoreline. You are not to bow down to them or serve them, for I, Adonai, your God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for the sins of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but displaying grace to the thousandth generation, to those who love me and obey my mitzvot." The very first set of mitzvot the people were given, they defiled, they abandoned, they ignored. I would say out of fear, but also out of ignorance as well. Not that they were lacking understanding or knowledge, but fear was in essence consuming their thoughts. To say Adonai was angry would be considered an understatement. We read in verse 8 of Exodus 32, "So quickly they have turned aside from the way I ordered them to follow. They have cast a metal statue of a calf, worshipped it, sacrificed to it, and said, 'Israel, here is your God who brought you up from the land of Egypt.'" Adonai continued speaking to Moses, and he said, "I have been watching these people, and you can see how stiff-necked they are. Now leave me alone so that my anger can blaze against them and I can put an end to them. I will make a great nation out of you instead." His anger blazed and was ready to cancel the people of Israel for their actions. Not of the past, but what was occurring in real time. They were still at Sinai, in the presence of Adonai, and he was with Moses on the mountain above. One might say he was in earshot. His desired actions were warranted. There was no speculation, no opinions, attempting to judge their actions. He had the smoking altar, not to mention the people caught in the very act by Moses, in verses 19 and 20. But at the moment Moses got near the camp, when he saw, eyewitness testimony, he saw the calf and the dancing, his own anger blazed up. He threw down the tablets he had been holding and shattered them at the base of the mountain. Seizing the calf they had made, he melted it in the fire and grounded it in powder, which he scattered on the water. Then he made the people of Israel drink it. Moses would advocate for the people on two occasions with Adonai. His intercession was to uncancel that which Adonai was aptly justified to cancel. The first time is when Moses urges Adonai not to destroy the people. Back in verses 11 through 14, Moses pleaded with Adonai, his God. He said, "Adonai, why must your anger blaze against your own people, whom you brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a strong hand? Why let the Egyptians say it was with evil intentions that he led them out, to slaughter them in the hills and wipe them off the face of the earth? Turn from your fierce anger. Relent," Moses tells God. "Don't bring such disaster on your people." I believe this is where chutzpah was born. "Remember Abraham, Yitzhak, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your very self. You promised them, 'I will make your descendants as many as the stars in the sky, and I will give all this land I have spoken about to your descendants, and they will possess it forever.'" I believe this is also where Jewish guilt first came. Moses was instilling upon God the promises that he made. His word was his bond. And what happened in verse 14? Adonai then changed his mind about the disaster he had planned for his people. Adonai did not change his mind as we do, but was reminded that what he was about to do, he could not do because he gave his word. And the second time is when Adonai reveals he will not go with the people, yet through Moses' intercession causes Adonai to relent again. In Exodus 33, verses 12 through 14, Moses said to Adonai, "Look, you say to me, make these people move on, but you haven't let me know whom you will be sending with me. Nevertheless, you have said, I know you by name, and also you have found favor in my sight. Now please, if it is really the case that I have found favor in your sight, show me your ways so that I will understand you and continue finding favor in your sight. Moreover, keep on seeing this nation as your people." He answered, "Set your mind at rest. My presence will go with you after all." I asked last week, where are Esther and Mordecai today? Today, the same question I can ask again. Where is Moses today? Where are people with the chutzpah and the ability to instill guilt like Moses? Keeping in mind, it wasn't the guilt, but it was the promise that God made that was his bond. Associated with this week's parsha in the Brit Chadashah are Romans 7 and 8, whereby Shaul offers a reverent perspective of Torah, the place where we find Adonai's mitzvot, a reverence towards the holiness of Adonai's word, and therefore Adonai himself, because you truly cannot separate one from the other. We read, starting in Romans 7, 7, "Therefore, what are we to say? That the Torah is sinful?" he asks. "Heaven forbid," he responds. He answers his own question. "Rather, the function of Torah was that without it, I would not have known what sin is. For example, I would not have become conscious of what greed is if the Torah had said, 'Thou shalt not covet.' But sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, worked in me all kinds of evil desires. For apart from Torah, sin is dead. I was once alive outside the framework of Torah." And what does he mean by this? There are no rules, no bounds outside of Torah. Therefore, you can do whatever you want. Eat, drink, and be merry. A scripture itself. He says, "I was once alive outside of the framework of Torah, but when the commandment really encountered me, sin sprang to life and I died. The commandment that was intended to bring me life was found to bring me death. For sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, deceived me. And through the commandment, sin killed me." Not the commandment, not the mitzvah or mitzvot, but it was the transgression. And then he concludes this way. "So the Torah is holy," that is, the commandment is holy, just, and good. Our standard by which we are to live does not change. The goalposts do not move. And thus we can be reassured of what Adonai desires of people who call upon the name of Adonai, the name of the Lord, the name of Yeshua, our Lord and God. Consider John chapter 20 in verses 27 and 28. "Then he said to Thomas, 'Put your finger here. Look at my hands. Take your hand and put it in my side. Don't be lacking trust, but have trust.' And Thomas answered," because he had the proof, "'My Lord and my God.'" Yet in this passage, getting back to Romans, in Shaul's letter to believers in Rome, both Jew and Gentile, he offers a rather transparent moment. For in verse 14, For we know that the Torah is of the Spirit. But as for me, I am bound to the old nature, sold to sin as a slave. I don't understand my own behavior. I don't do what I want to do. Instead, I do the very thing I hate. Now, if I am doing what I don't want to do, I am agreeing that the Torah is good. But now it is no longer the real me doing it, but the sin housed inside me. It would appear that Shaul has his own struggles, just as we all do, present rabbi included. Shaul does not elaborate on his struggles, yet they are known to him because Adonai's word and thus his mitzvot are known. Shaul explores the frustration of everyone who has ever failed to live up to the principles which he knows are right. Anyone with a bad habit knows the truth of these verses all too well. Consider 1 John 1:8. If we claim not to have sinned, we are deceiving ourselves, and the truth is not in us. Shaul is making a real statement. He struggles. We all struggle. And Shaul, having written just 4 chapters previously, in chapter 3, starting in verse 21, but now, quite apart from Torah, God's way of making people righteous in his sight has been made clear, although the Torah and the prophets give their witness to it as well. And it is a righteousness that comes from God through the faithfulness of Yeshua the Messiah to all who continue trusting, for it makes no difference whether one is a Jew or a Gentile, since all have sinned and come short of earning God's praise. Thus, Shaul is not conveying a woe is me narrative, but great is he in spite of me narrative. And thus we read in Romans 8 as this narrative continues, therefore there is no longer any condemnation awaiting those who are in union with Messiah Yeshua. Why? Because the Torah of the Spirit which produces this life in union with Messiah has set us free from the Torah of sin and death. The Torah of the Spirit is the Torah given at Sinai, the very word spoken. It is not anything different. And the Torah of sin and death is not the Old Testament. The Torah of sin and death is the very opposite of what the Torah of the Spirit is. Because if you think about it, when you're told not to do something, the Torah of sin says do it. When you're told to do something, the Torah of sin says don't do it. So it's the exact opposite. It is a counterfeit. For what the Torah could not do by itself, because it lacked the power to make the old nature cooperate, God did by sending his Son as a human being with a nature like our own, sinful one, but without sin. God did this in order to deal with sin. And in so doing, he executed the punishment against sin in human nature, so that the just requirement of the Torah might be fulfilled in us who do not run our lives according to what our old nature wants, but according to what the Spirit wants. So I believe he was very real here. There is an intolerance that exists today among people. We see it in society, on social media, and even within the body of Messiah. Quick to judge, slow to understand. The standard is one strike and you're out, using a baseball analogy, saying it's spring training. Not to mention, you don't know what the strike zone is because it's constantly changing. There was this analogy, depending on the umpire you got for a game would determine the strike zone because each of them interpreted their strike zone differently. Judgment and cancellation are not the same. Judgment by Adonai offers a standard by which has been made known and is not subject to change. Well, cancellation offers a subjective standard by which changes on a regular basis occur. What may have been acceptable yesterday is not acceptable today. Thus, I want to leave you with the words Adonai inspired Isaiah to write. Haven't you known? Haven't you heard that the everlasting God, Adonai, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not grow tired or weary? His understanding cannot be fathomed. He invigorates the exhausted. He gives strength to the powerless. Young men may grow tired and weary. Even the fittest may stumble and fall. But, hope you were waiting for a but, because there's a but here. But those who hope in Adonai will renew their strength. They will soar aloft as with eagle's wings. When they are running, they won't grow weary. When they are walking, they won't get tired. So regardless of what's going on, regardless of what you may be confronted with, know that the standards of God remain constant. His ways are immovable and do not change. What was the same yesterday is the same today and will be the same tomorrow. Thus, you do not have to worry about being canceled by God, but you must be concerned with being judged by God, and there is a difference. There is no sliding scale. There are no indulgences that you can offer to grease the palm, so to speak. But keeping in mind, everything that I have shared with you, the intolerance of cancel culture, I equate to the Torah of sin, because everything this narrative is, God is not. God is not looking to cancel, but God is looking to redeem. God is looking to restore. God is not looking to silence you, but to give you a voice, because you are his witness when you accept him. So keep these things in mind, because you will likely be confronted with them, maybe when you leave here, maybe tomorrow, maybe next week. But chances are you're going to say something that will be offensive to someone for whatever reason. It's almost like 10 years ago, actually 11 years ago now, when they were getting ready to vote on Obamacare. And it was uncertain what was going to be in the bill. Well, how can you vote for something that you don't know that's in there? And keeping in mind there's complications within government with regards to amendments that get put in and taken out. And these words were conveyed by the speaker at the time. You'll know what's in it when we pass it. You don't have to worry about that with God. You don't have to worry about, well, am I or am I not? You have his standard before you, and it's made known. So if everybody will please rise.